So, in 2026, the average mid-market company is going to just hemorrhage hundreds of thousands of dollars on secure API tools before, like, a single line of code ever even goes to production.
Oh, absolutely. And the really crazy part, they do it entirely voluntarily.
Right. Completely voluntarily. And I mean, if you're listening to this, you are probably a business leader or, a tech adjacent professional, and you know this pressure intimately.
Yeah, the pressure is just unrelenting right now.
It really is. Budgets are super tight, security expectations are sky high, and the mandate from the board is always just, modernize. So you start staring down the barrel of this massive secure API development project.
Which is an incredibly precarious position to be in. I mean, the stakes today are just unforgiving.
Yeah, your digital infrastructure has to talk to the outside world, but you also know that buying a solution to a problem you haven't fully diagnosed is, well, it's the fastest way to cripple your own operation.
Exactly. We've totally moved past the era where, a slick slide deck and a charismatic sales engineer were enough to close a deal.
Right. Those days are gone.
They really are. Buyers, the smart ones anyway, they don't want a good pitch anymore. They're demanding empirical, hard evidence before they trust a single recommendation. Because the blast radius of a failed ATI integration today, it's catastrophic.
It's massive, which is exactly why we're jumping into today's deep dive. We are dissecting a really specific, timely source document today, which is the Secure API Development Checklist for Growing Businesses in 2026.
It's a great framework. Really dense, but great.
Super dense. So our mission today is to basically extract the absolute most critical insights from this guide to help you slow down your decision-making just enough to avoid stepping into the tool-first trap.
Ah, the tool-first trap. Such a classic blunder.
Right. It's where an initiative looks spectacular in like a kickoff meeting, but morphs into an absolute operational nightmare 6 months later.
And it's worth mentioning that while this particular guide was developed specifically to help companies in Orange County and Southern California, the friction it's addressing is completely universal.
Yeah, the geographic origin might be local, but the pain points, the operational risk, the completely ambiguous internal ownership, the agonizingly weak documentation, those are global realities.
Yeah, if you are scaling a business anywhere right now, these are the exact friction points where your momentum will just completely stall.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Okay.
Because if we want to avoid a disastrous tech decision, we first have to really examine the psychological reality of how teams actually make these choices when they're stressed out.
That's a great point. The psychology is half the battle.
Because the material highlights this fascinating quirk about human nature. When a team starts frantically Googling for a, secure API development checklist, it's almost always a symptom of a deeper disease.
Yeah, that frantic search is a massive red flag. It's basically an anxiety response.
Right. It means they already feel a huge gap in their operations.
Exactly. It usually indicates this fundamental breakdown in trust or process or visibility within the organization.
Like maybe your current vendor relationship relies way too heavily on blind faith rather than, verifiable performance.
Or maybe your data reporting is just inconsistent and leadership is losing confidence in the numbers. The core philosophy here is that a truly useful plan has to translate that chaotic, frantic energy into a concrete set of decisions.
Decisions that everyone can intuitively grasp, right? From the executives all the way down to the frontline tech stakeholders.
Exactly.
Which brings us to what I honestly thought was the most brilliant mechanism in this entire document. As I was reading, I noticed this one specific set of four questions, followed by a practical next step, and it's repeated relentlessly.
Yes, it's hammered into the text over and over again.
It operates like this cognitive anchor.
What's fascinating here is how deliberate that repetition is. I mean, when leaders are under intense pressure and they're drowning in this sea of technical jargon about, microservices and authentication
Well,
protocols,
they lose sight of the fundamentals.
they completely lose sight of them. So this framework forces you to document your current state and definitively choose a business outcome before you are even allowed to look at a vendor.
Before you even open a browser to search for software.
Right. By injecting those four questions continuously, it acts as a circuit breaker. It forces you to stop, take a breath, and return to first principles.
So let's look at that ultimate four-question mantra because it really strips away all the marketing fluff. Question one, what evidence supports the recommendation?
So crucial.
Right. Question two, who owns the outcome after launch? Question three, what risks should be handled before implementation? And question four, How will success be measured after 30, 60, and 90 days?
Those questions are just brilliantly designed to enforce immediate accountability.
Notice how literally none of them ask about the specific technology?
Exactly. They are entirely focused on mechanics, ownership, and measurable reality, not the shiny features.
And the practical next step that permanently anchors those questions is just as vital. It essentially says, document the current state, choose the single most important business outcome, and create a short action plan assigning ownership and timing.
It sounds so basic, right?
It sounds incredibly basic, but teams routinely skip it because they just want to get to the shiny new software.
Everybody wants to buy the new toy.
Right. But buying an API management platform before defining the business outcome is like, it's like buying an industrial grade robotics arm for a factory floor before you even know if you're assembling microchips or packing boxes of cereal.
That is a perfect analogy. You're optimizing for a physical motion without having any idea what the payload is.
Exactly. You have to define the risk and the customer experience first.
You really do. You cannot optimize a process that hasn't been defined. You absolutely must start with the outcome.
So define the actual business process that's broken.
Right. Or the one that needs acceleration. And only after you've mapped that reality do you begin to look at vendors or data silos or access rights.
That focus on defining reality brings us directly to the second question in that mantra. Who owns the outcome after launch? Which naturally transitions us from the abstract goals to the actual human beings internally responsible for the project.
Because you can have the most crystal clear business goal in the world.
Yeah.
But if the internal structure is flawed,
the initiative just evaporates.
It just disappears. This is what we call the architecture of accountability.
And the source is incredibly rigid here. It mandates an internal ownership model featuring four distinct roles.
Yes. You must have an executive sponsor, a business owner, a technical owner, and an operational reviewer.
Okay. Now, I am going to push back on this heavily on behalf of everyone listening. Because if you are running a lean, aggressive startup with like 50 people, you are moving fast.
Sure.
Dividing this up into four formal titles feels like you're just LARPing corporate bureaucracy. I mean, it feels incredibly heavy and slow. Doesn't this just create a mountain of red tape?
That is hands down the most common objection. And it makes intuitive sense if you view those as job titles. But the framework draws a hard line here for a very specific reason.
Which is?
Without visible, clearly defined ownership of these specific domains, even a brilliant technical recommendation loses its momentum after the very first kickoff meeting.
Because everyone assumes someone else is handling it.
Exactly. Now, in a lean company, one person might absolutely wear three of those hats. But the responsibilities themselves must remain distinct and visible.
But wait, even if one person is wearing multiple hats, aren't they just, like, arguing with themselves? And even with different people, I imagine the technical owner and business owner naturally butt heads all the time.
Oh, constantly.
Right. One wants to ship features at lightning speed to capture market share, and the other wants ultimate stability and, you know, zero technical debt. How does this framework actually resolve that friction?
By forcing those exact distinct perspectives into the light. The business owner defines the outcome. They dictate what problem we are actually solving. The technical owner validates feasibility. They determine if the current infrastructure can actually support this without collapsing. And the friction you mentioned, it's healthy, provided there's a tiebreaker.
Ah, and that's where the operational reviewer comes in.
Exactly. They confirm the day-to-day fit. They're the ones asking, will our actual staff use this, or will it require them to click through 14 extra screens, causing them to abandon the tool entirely?
So the operational reviewer is essentially the voice of end user adoption.
Spot on. And then the executive sponsor sits above it all to just, you know, remove the blockers. They hold the purse strings and have the political capital to push through departmental resistance.
So if those four functions aren't clashing and collaborating, the project stalls out.
Precisely. That internal alignment is the absolute foundation. Because if your internal house isn't in order, that agility you prize in a lean company is actually a liability.
Because a sharp external partner will exploit a lack of internal consensus.
Oh, a bad vendor will run right through that gap.
Which transitions us perfectly to dealing with the outside world. Once you know what you want and who is running it, you inevitably have to judge these third-party vendors.
And that is where things get really tricky.
Yeah, the material details this 2026 scorecard to evaluate outside help, and the entire premise rests on scoring them with hard evidence, not sales promises.
Yeah, you just cannot accept adjectives in 2026. You must demand artifacts.
Artifacts. I like that. The scorecard lists criteria like capability, implementation quality, scalability, and cost transparency. But let's dive into the mechanics of how you actually score these.
Sure.
Take the support model, for example. Every vendor on Earth will tell you they have best-in-class support. How do you evaluate that with hard evidence?
Well, a real support model artifact isn't just a slick slide saying 247 support. It is a highly granular escalation matrix.
Okay, so what does that look like in practice?
You demand to see exactly what happens step by step. When your customer data API throws a 500 internal server error at 2 a.m. on a Sunday.
Right. Who gets paged?
Exactly. Who gets paged? What is the guaranteed response time? How is the post-mortem documented? Mm. If they cannot produce that matrix, their support is a fiction.
The text also waves some massive red flags to watch out for during this evaluation phase. Vague scope, unclear access control, pricing that conveniently obscures the ongoing maintenance costs.
Typical vendor traps.
Yeah, but one of the most terrifying warnings is the lack of a rollback plan.
It is shocking. Truly shocking how often this is overlooked. I mean, if the integration fails on day one and corrupts your database, how exactly do we revert to yesterday's state?
And if a vendor brushes that question off...
You terminate the meeting. Seriously. Walk away.
Wow. But the source highlights an even bigger red flag, actually, one that completely disqualifies a vendor. It says if a potential partner cannot clearly mechanically describe how the work will be measured in the first 90 days after launch, the project is simply not ready. Period.
That is the ultimate litmus test.
Why do vendors dodge that 90-day question so often?
Because the first 90 days is where the theoretical meets the painfully real. Vendors dodge it because committing to a specific 90-day measurable outcome strips away their ability to hide behind vague, ongoing optimization retainers.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah. Strong partners don't just say yes to your grand vision. They will actively force you to narrow the scope of the initial project, acknowledge the trade-offs, and prove the concept first.
And if we're talking about long-term consequences with vendors, we definitely have to talk about lock-in. You build this incredible secure API ecosystem with a partner, and 3 years later, you realize you can't leave them without effectively breaking your own business.
It happens all the time.
How does this framework suggest we avoid that trap?
By establishing exit readiness before you sign a single document, you are essentially negotiating the divorce before the marriage.
It's like building a custom house on leased land where the landlord secretly owns all the plumbing. The house looks great, but if you try to move, you realize you don't actually control the pipes.
Exactly. So to avoid that, you demand documentation, data export protocols, and a really clear transition process up front.
Well, you still have leverage.
Right. Most importantly, you must establish explicitly who owns the code, the API configuration, and the administrative credentials. You secure those handoff steps before the contract is signed, because that leverage evaporates the moment the ink is dry.
So if the inability to explain the first 90 days is the ultimate vendor deal breaker, we really need to know exactly what a functioning 90-day plan looks like under the hood.
Right. And the material breaks this down into a highly structured 30-60-90-day blueprint.
Okay, let's go through it. According to the blueprint, the first 30 days are purely dedicated to clarifying the current state and identifying priority gaps.
Which is a structure specifically designed to mitigate the sunk cost fallacy.
But there is zero building happening here. Why take a full month just to look around?
Because looking around in an API context means mapping really complex data flows, identifying shadow IT that your departments are secretly using, and understanding legacy dependencies.
Oh, right. Shadow IT is a huge blind spot.
It is. And if you skip this mapping phase, your brilliant new API pilot will inevitably break some critical legacy system in production simply because nobody knew they were connected.
That makes total sense. Then the next 30 days, so days 31 to 60, is where you finally implement or pilot the single highest value improvement. You aren't boiling the ocean. It's one focused, measurable push.
Exactly. Keep it tight.
And the final 30 days. You rigorously review the results, document the lessons learned, and make a hard executive decision. Do we continue, expand, or adjust?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this 90-day structure is basically the ultimate antidote to executive anxiety.
How so?
Well, it prevents the creation of zombie initiatives.
Yeah.
You know, those massive open-ended terror projects that drain budgets for years without ever delivering verifiable ROI.
Oh, yeah. We've all seen those.
Right. In 90 days, leadership gets hard data, a functioning pilot, and a clear, highly practical decision point.
Yeah.
No endless waiting.
But to review those results effectively in that final 30 days, you need unassailable metrics. The framework dictates a mix of business, technical, and operational indicators.
You need a balanced view.
Right. So we're talking about things like response time improvements, lead quality, API downtime reduction, or even the raw number of security findings resolved during code reviews.
And here is the absolute critical mechanism for all of this.
Hmm.
The metric must be chosen before implementation starts.
Yes. The text is extremely rigid about this. If you don't establish the metric beforehand, you fall victim to the sharpshooter fallacy.
Oh, exactly.
It's like letting a casino dictate the rules of roulette after the wheel has already stopped spinning. Oh, the ball landed on black. Well, today we're only paying out on red.
Right. The team will just invent success after the fact by pointing to whatever metric happened to go up, completely ignoring the massive failures everywhere else.
Exactly. It renders the entire pilot meaningless.
Yeah. The metric is your objective truth. It removes the emotion and the internal politics from the evaluation process.
So we have our metrics, our strict 90-day timeline, our internal team wearing their distinct hats, and we've aggressively vetted our vendor using hard evidence. We're ready to build.
Sounds like it.
But an ATI pilot on day 45 can still blow up the entire company if the operational risks aren't managed. This brings us to the actual rollout, specifically the massive landmines of security and documentation.
In 2026, attempting to separate a technology decision from a security decision is basically operational malpractice. They're the exact same conversation.
The source is adamant about this, even if the pilot you're running is just a seemingly benign, you know, marketing analytics integration. The organization still has to rigorously protect credentials, customer information, and administrative privileges.
Because we aren't just talking about someone guessing a weak password anymore. We are talking about highly complex systemic vulnerabilities.
Like what? Give me an example.
For instance, token expiration mismanagement, where an access token lives forever and eventually gets compromised.
Yikes.
Or over-permission microservices.
Mm-hmm.
That happens a lot during a lean rollout. You inadvertently give a third-party vendor read and write access to your entire centralized database when they really only needed to read one specific table.
Right. An unsecured API in a marketing tool isn't just a marketing problem. It's a structural backdoor into your core infrastructure.
Exactly.
And to manage this terrifying level of complexity, the framework leans heavily on documentation. Honestly, it surprised me how much real estate in this modern guide was dedicated to just writing things down. It feels almost analog.
I know. It might feel analog, but it is literally the DNA sequence of your digital infrastructure.
Wow. DNA sequence.
Yeah. Documentation cannot be postponed until the end of the project when the budget is completely gone and the engineers are exhausted. The text mandates continuous logging of decision notes, architecture diagrams, maintenance steps, and a super granular change history.
Why is it such a vital signal of a good partner, though?
Because it protects the continuity of the company. It proves that a partner is deeply disciplined. I mean, think about it. What happens when your lead engineer leaves for a competitor?
You're flying blind.
Right. Or what happens if a vendor completely alters their pricing model and you have to rebuild everything? Documentation ensures that the next generation of engineers can understand not just what was built, but exactly why a specific technical compromise was made 3 years ago.
It's institutional memory.
Exactly. Institutional memory.
That reframes it perfectly. It's not administrative paperwork. It's operational insurance. Now, during this rollout phase, the text highlights some really catastrophic execution mistakes.
There are quite a few.
Teams routinely rush from executive approval straight to implementation without confirming legacy dependencies. Or they completely underestimate the training required for the end user.
Or they skip user acceptance testing, which just essentially guarantees the product will fail upon contact with reality.
Right. But the most dangerous mistake, and the one that apparently creates the most chaos, is leaving old workflows running parallel to the new API integrations for way too long.
Oh, this is a huge one. It's so common.
Dive into the mechanics of that. Why are parallel workflows so destructive?
Because it creates a split brain scenario within your organization.
Split brain?
Yeah. If half your team is using the new automated API workflow,
mm-hmm.
and the other half stubbornly refuses to adopt it and just keeps using the old manual CSV exports.
You have two completely different sets of numbers.
Exactly. Mm. You suddenly have two conflicting versions of truth in your central systems. Data integrity completely collapses. A truly disciplined rollout actively unplugs the old systems to force adoption, provided the new system has been rigorously tested, of course.
You have to burn the boats.
You really do.
Now, throughout this entire deep dive, we have been pulling from a framework designed by an organization called Technigian. The material notes that they are heavily involved with Southern California companies, helping them translate these exact concepts into practical action plans.
Yes, they execute the granular work. Things like running baseline audits, driving Microsoft 365 security improvements, managing ongoing service plans, and conducting custom software assessments.
And the crucial takeaway regarding groups like Technigian is the timing of their involvement. The framework strongly advises bringing them in before a final vendor decision is actually made.
You need that objective assessment while your internal team still has the flexibility to validate requirements.
Right, and compare distinct architectural paths. If you wait until you've already signed a contract, you've painted yourself into a corner.
You have zero leverage left.
Exactly. And for those of you who want to explore the broader context of API security standards on your own, the text rightly points out resources from osf.org and nist.gov as the absolute gold standards.
Those are non-negotiable resources if you want to align your internal practices with really rigorous global security expectations and contractual compliance.
So, what does this all mean? We've navigated the psychological friction of the tool-first trap, the absolute necessity of the four-question mantra, the deliberate friction of internal ownership, the evidence-based vendor scorecard, the strict parameters of the 90-day blueprint, and the operational insurance of rigorous documentation.
That's a lot to take in.
It's a ton. How do we synthesize all of these mechanisms?
Well, the overarching philosophy of this guide is really a paradigm shift. A secure API development checklist is not a static, one-time technical chore.
Right.
If you treat it like a grocery list, you will fail. Instead, you have to view it as a continuous dynamic bridge. It is a living structure that permanently connects your business impact, your security posture, your cost transparency, your implementation quality, and your ongoing operational support.
A continuous bridge. I love that. So, to you listening, the practical next step for you today is incredibly clear, and it comes straight from the source. Document your current state. Choose a singular, highly specific business outcome.
And do that before you take another vendor meeting.
Exactly. Define the payload before you buy the heavy machinery.
This raises an important question, though, one that isn't explicitly resolved in the text, but naturally follows this entire framework.
Oh, what's that?
Well, we spend all this time, all this meticulous, agonizing planning on the first 90 days of an API's life. We obsess over the rollout and the initial adoption, but what about its end of life? In a 2026 tech landscape where business models can pivot literally overnight, what happens when the secure APIs we so carefully build today end up outliving the very business realities they were designed to support? How do you securely, elegantly sunset a digital bridge that nobody in the organization even remembers how to cross?
Oof. A digital bridge to nowhere, slowly rusting in the background and creating massive security vulnerabilities.
Exactly.
That is a chilling thought to leave on, but an absolutely vital one to consider as you architect your long-term tech strategy. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Go tackle those 90-day plans, demand evidence, document everything, and we will catch you next time.